Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Helen Crane. And coming up, mortgage rates are back on the rise. Are we at risk of another spike? Could the Bank of England ease the pain of mortgage holders at their next meeting? And what is going on over in the States? Also today, should you really pay as much as possible into your pension? Crane is on the crypto case. And what on earth are passkeys? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade-in shares, funds, investment trusts and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, for the second time in a week, Santander has upped its fixed-rate mortgage deals, and it is not alone. Last week, more than 20 lenders increased their rates, including the likes of TSB, Halifax and HSBC. This week, more joined them. So, Simon Lambert, are we headed for another spike? But before we get there, firstly, welcome to you both. Helen, if you would. Santander, what's going on here? How much extra are we talking about? A little smidge up or a big whacking great hike twice?
Somewhere in between, really. So they've put them up by up to 26 basis points. But that's on top of another increase that they did earlier in the week. So all in all, I think some of their deals could be going up by about 50 basis points. So it is, it's
chunky.
A fair whack. Yeah, and it's just to say, it's actually not just Santander. So over the last couple of weeks, we've seen rate hikes from almost all the big high street lenders. So TSB, Halifax, HSBC, Barclays, NatWest, Nationwide. So all the big high street names. If you're looking to buy a home or you're looking to remortgage, that is going to be a bit of a concern. This is sort of off the back of more pessimistic predictions about where the base rate might go, which have happened over the last few weeks. So obviously fixed rate mortgages are influenced quite heavily by what's happening to the base rate. And we've seen predictions which earlier in the year people were saying, you know, the base rate might be cut 6 or 7 times by the end of this year. People are now saying maybe just 2, 3, 4 times. So more kind of conservative outlook on that, which is obviously filtering through to mortgage rates. So not good news for anyone who needs to take out a new mortgage at the moment.
Give us some figures before we get Simon's take on this. What are we talking about now in terms of sort of mortgage rates and the best deals you can find out there? What are we looking at?
The absolute cheapest rates that you can get at the moment, and these are obviously with people who have the largest amounts of equity in their home. So this is people who are looking at a 60% loan to value. The cheapest 5-year fix is 4.24%, and the cheapest 2-year fix is 4.6%. So the average 2-year fix, this is looking across all deposit sizes, is 5.91%, and the average 5-year fix is 5.48%.
Right. Lovely. Simon, not really lovely, though, is it? We got a bit of optimism at the start of the year. What's happened?
Well, what's happened is that the outlook for interest rates has shifted. Regular listeners will recall many conversations about interest rates on this podcast. It's a favourite topic of this podcast. We love to talk about interest rates. And one of the things that we've loved to talk about interest rates this year is whether the market was getting somewhat ahead of itself with the expectation that the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve, perhaps more importantly, were going to be cutting interest rates so many times this year. You could see the expectations of this most obviously in the futures market for interest rates, but also in the stock market, where we'd seen this big run up in US growth shares and the expectation the Fed might cut 3 or 4 times this year. To me, that always seemed a bit excessive. But why would they do that? It's taken central banks so long to get interest rates anywhere back to normal. In the US, they've got an economy that's running hot. And they've got demand-led inflation. In the UK, we had inflation that was stickier, Bank of England that was still worrying about wage rises, and also a Bank of England that seemed to think that the increases it had done were enough to bring inflation down, but certainly weren't going to be triggering a deflationary or disinflationary period. So why would the Bank of England be cutting rates three times this year? It looks like those interest rate expectations have now caught up with the mortgage market somewhat. And so what we've seen is that the rush of cuts at the end of last year has stalled and has now turned into a series of rises. The concern, I guess, for most people is, do we risk another spike? We saw two of those in the space of 12 months recently. We saw the inflation panic last summer, and we saw the Liz Truss mini budget delivered panic in the autumn before that. The Truss and Quasi-Kwarteng, what should we call it? Ill-fated mini budget this time around. I think we've got ill-fated on this podcast. Was an understandable reaction. The inflation mini panic last summer was a bit less obviously so. There just seemed to be a massive freak out off the back of some not quite so good inflation figures. That was a real overreaction. And then it became a vicious circle as one lender raises rates, another lender raises rates, and so on and so on. And you just had day after day after day, you had lenders raising rates. You look at Santander raising rates twice in a week and you think, that looks a bit worryingly suspicious, but I don't think it's anywhere near that bad. I think this is just what brokers and mortgage lenders like to euphemistically call a repricing. Just a repricing, just a little repricing. Move along here, nothing to see, just a little repricing. But I mean, I think it is, you know, worth noting and talking about the fact that mortgage rates are way higher than they were a few years ago. They're lower than they were during either of those spikes, but they are way higher than they were a few years ago.
So repricing, blip, whatever you want to call it, you have actually been talking to the experts in your article. What have they been telling you about the state of the market generally?
It's difficult, isn't it? Because I think, as Simon says, this is, as they say, repricing. And I think the sense in brokers is that perhaps when mortgage rates were being cut quite substantially at the start of the year, that was perhaps a bit, lenders maybe got a bit overexcited, thinking that things were all going in the right direction and maybe cut a little bit more than they should have. So the thing that we always talk about when we look at mortgage rates is swap rates, which are, to explain them briefly, it's quite complicated, but they're sort of mortgage lending rates that sort of indicate where lenders think mortgage rates are going in the future. And mortgage rates at the start of the year were getting quite close to swap rates, which never really happened. You know, they very, very rarely go below the level of swap rates, and it was kind of getting close to that. So I think maybe of over-optimism at the start of the year, and this is kind of that correcting out. But if you are coming off, say, a five-year fix that you, could have been around 2%, and you're now having to go on to 4% plus, you know, that is difficult for people, especially, you know, people who've still got quite big mortgages. It can have a really big impact on people. And I think that's kind of feeding through to some of the stuff that we're seeing from the house price indexes. You know, smaller houses are now becoming a lot more popular than really big houses. I think people are sort of tempering in their expectations a bit, thinking, you know, I'm going to be a bit more sensible about what I'm buying, what I can afford. You know, that the housing market is still kind of ticking over. We're not seeing a crash in terms of, you know, prices or people looking for new homes. But I think there's a real sort of air of people being quite sensible at the moment, which I think is what this is all kind of coming to.
So, in sum, if you are someone who's coming off a fixed deal, etc., you know, as much as we say this is a repricing, this is a blip or something, it's a worrying thing because it's that instability, isn't it? It doesn't serve anyone very well. So what should you be looking at? Has the advice changed from where it was a couple of months ago?
In one sense, I think the advice never really changes, which is that when you're looking for a new mortgage, there's essentially two things to look at. What can you afford is obviously the main one. If you're looking to move, for example, can you actually afford that? Could you still afford that if rates went up by another percent, which is still, while unlikely, could still be on the table. First of all, can you actually afford this mortgage? And also, what do you think is going to happen to rates in the future, which is really difficult to tell. But for example, one thing people have been doing recently is opting for a two-year fix because they've thought that then by the time they have to fix their mortgage again, hopefully rates will have gone down, they'll be able to get a cheaper deal. But now some brokers are saying, well, you know, actually, that might not necessarily happen. We could end up in 2 years' time with rates still perhaps around the same kind of level they are now, or, you know, could be even a bit higher, could be a bit lower. But it's unlikely that in 2 years' time, we're going to be back to 1 or 2% mortgage rates. So I think that's something to think about, because at the minute, 2 year fixes are more expensive than 5 years. And I think perhaps someone could take the view that if interest rates aren't going to change very much in the next 5 years, perhaps fixing for slightly cheaper for 5 years maybe isn't a bad option. It's always a sort of judgment call. One thing that's really important to do, I think, is talk to a broker, because they'll be able to advise you on this, what your best option might be. And they'll also have access to the best deals on the market. You know, they'll be able to look at everything that's out there and hopefully get you a best deal than you'd be able to get by yourself. So I think it's time to sort of take advice and really have a good think about where your finances are at and what your view is on what might happen going forward.
Sound advice as always there, Helen. Simon, we have a Bank of England meeting next week. What are we expecting?
I think we're expecting a firm hold. Odds on for a hold. Nobody's expecting a cut in May. There were expectations of a potential cut in May earlier in the year, and there's certainly some rumbling from some quarters saying that they should cut in May. And you might even manage to find the odd analyst or economist who says they could surprise us. But I think if you look at the voting from last time round, and if you look at what the Bank of England has been saying, dependent on the data and all that kind of stuff, inflation has been coming down. I think they're very comfortable with rates being where they are to bring inflation down, but they're also not worrying hugely that rates being at the level they're at, 5.25%, is seriously hampering the economy. The question is whether if we delivered a cut, it would give the economy a little boost, the little, you know, jump start that it needs to get things moving a bit better, because it's sluggish at best at the moment. I don't know whether, you know, that would be the case. I do know they're going to be watching this mortgage scenario quite closely, quite carefully, because there's an interesting thing going on here, which is, as Helen mentioned earlier, this is hitting the housing market in a different way. So the evidence is that it's definitely hitting first-time buyers, that there's been a real slowdown in first-time buyers, because first-time buyers are looking at it and going, well, we finally managed to get the deposit together. We thought we were ready to buy, and then mortgage rates went up, and now we can't afford the mortgage that we thought. That effect is now easing a bit because prices have come down and first-time buyers are able to negotiate, you know, pretty decently on price, and mortgage levels have come down. But then that brings more first-time buyers into the market and more competition. So then you can't negotiate as well as you could on price, because there might be another first-time buyer who wants that property rather than there being a queue of nobody behind you. The middle of the market isn't, you know, the sort of just moderately expensive homes. I was going to say less expensive homes, but all homes in the UK tend to be expensive. The moderately expensive homes aren't being hit so bad. You know, the market's readjusted, prices have come down a bit, people have gone, well, do you know what, we want to move and we could afford a few extra £100 a month or whatever. The bit of the market that's being hit really hard by this is what is judged to be the upper end of the market, not like the top end, not the super prime, you know, £10 million, £5 million houses bit. But the bits that make up a substantial chunk and driver of the UK economy, by which I mean, you know, that huge chunk of the kind of southeast of the country where detached family homes can quite easily be £1 million or more, you know, or substantially more. And you've got people who took out £500,000 mortgages to buy them. And if you've got a £500,000 mortgage, the difference between paying 1.5% and 4.5% is about £700 a month. So 1.5% with 20 years left on your mortgage is £2,400 a month. At 4.5% for the same person, it would be £3,163 a month. Now, so you're basically looking at 750 quid more. For those people who are in the position to be taking on £500,000 mortgages, that's roughly equivalent to about £1,400 or £1,500 of pre-tax pay. That's a lot of money every month. And people don't have, you know, their wages have gone up. You know, we've had kind of near inflation matching at points pay rises, but not by that much. And all the rest of their bills have gone up as well. Their energy bills, their TV, their broadband. If they've got car finance is the killer for a lot of people with these PCP deals. You know, they've got, people are forking out a few hundred pounds a month or much more on their cars and things like that. There's a big squeeze going on those people. And the mortgage element is a big factor. People in that market are not able to be paying the prices that they were for houses before. I mean, I live in one of those areas and I regularly see houses go on the market and then have £100,000 chopped off the price. Oof. You know, so I saw one the other day. It was a house that like we had seen previously, right? And it went on the market for 1.2 million and within a week it was down to 1.1 because obviously they'd had no interest and they decided to go in a bit higher and then cut the price. And people are looking at this and going, well, you know, they might cut the price, so I'm gonna sit and wait, see if the asking price gets cut. I mean, it obviously depends on the motivation of the seller, but that's quite a hefty cut. And you're seeing that kind of top end of the market. This is playing out around all of that kind of London commuter belt and everything. You're seeing those prices being chopped. It's not so much of an issue for people who were selling the houses after owning them for a very long time, but if they bought them relatively recently, then they might end up finding that they're selling for less than they paid for. I mean, that would have to be really quite recently. But you've also got the issue where, and this is like a relatively small chunk of people, but it does have a drag on things, where a lot of the people coming off fixed rates who've suddenly discovered that they're going to have to pay £600 or £700 a month more on their mortgage are just going to find the money. It's going to be hard for them to find the money, but they are able to find the money. It's going to be choice. They're going to make choices. Like, holidays are going to be cut. The car on the PCP deal is going back and they buy a cheap secondhand car. You know, money's just not going to be going into savings or investments instead, and so on. But there will be other people for whom they're already at breaking point and they're like, we don't have that extra money. And they're not the kind of people that you think of as normally being at break. To the outward eye, they probably won't look like they're at breaking point. They might look like they're living very high on the hog. Got the expensive SUV on the drive, got a couple of holidays a year, all that other stuff, all the trappings. But people spend to their income, you know. It's very true that, you know, that people earn lots of money and then they spend lots of money. And some of those people are going to be feeling the squeeze and then they're going to be going, right, well, we need to sell up. We can't afford this house that we thought we could afford and this lifestyle we thought we could afford. And we're going to move down the ladder. But they might be discovering that they're going to get £100,000, £200,000 less for the house than they thought. And it's only a small chunk of the market. And there's going to be podcast listeners in other parts of the country or other scenarios going, what is this lunatic talking about? These idiots who live, you know, in the southeast of the country, honestly, they should all be just put in the sea. But you do have to remember that that is a bit of the economy that has a habit of really driving some of the consumer growth that we see in this country. And you shouldn't downplay the effects.
Indeed. Before we move on, Simon, I just want a quick one about what's going on over in the States. We spoke about the Bank of England here and what might happen with rates. Well, what's happening with the Fed? A lot of noise.
Well, as a wonderful illustration of how the mood music has changed on interest rates, the Fed felt compelled to come out this week whilst holding interest rates and explain that it probably wasn't going to put them up next time round, or the next move wasn't going to be up. Which is quite the turnaround, considering, as I said earlier, there was talk of three or four Fed rate cuts this year. Inflation has been stickier in the US. It had dropped quite steeply. It's then been stickier, and it's actually now gone up a bit over there. Because the economy's running pretty hot. It's pretty demand-led. You know, the US economy is thriving at the moment. You can put it down to what you want to put it down to, the post-COVID recovery, the fact that the reshoring boom, the Biden's Green Deal, you know, thing where he's investing loads of money into renewable energy and green projects, which also feeds into the reshoring and everything, the kind of virtuous circle of how a consumer economy works, You know, money goes in, people spend money, money goes round, the stock market doing well, whatever you want to put it down to, US economy is doing pretty good. Is in a very different position to the UK economy. So the concerns about inflation there stem from different things. You know, ours were very much external, whereas quite a bit of theirs is internal. So there were concerns that actually maybe they need to raise rates again, rather than cutting them four times. But Jerome Powell came out and said, yeah, we're probably not gonna do that. So right. I mean, that doesn't help bring down inflation.
No.
Well, we're probably not gonna raise rates. People need to be slightly concerned that you are going to raise rates.
Okay. Well, we'll see. We'll see what happens. This week's crane on the case, let's go there now, shall we? Involves something I've always wondered about. With so much information on our phones, all the banking apps that we have, what if it gets stolen? What could the muggers do if they get all access to all of that information? Helen, sort of feeds into your story this week. Crane back on the case. Tell me about it.
Exactly. So I started off calling this a scam, and it actually isn't a scam. It's just a bare-faced crime, really. No one's kind of being tricked into anything. So this is something that's sadly becoming more and more common. I've had quite a few people write into me to say that this has happened to them. It's actually also happened to a friend of mine. Someone will be on a night out, probably had a few drinks. We don't begrudge people that on this podcast, or all good, out having a good time. They'll be outside, maybe outside a pub, waiting for a taxi, kind of about to go home. And someone will come behind them and they'll take their phone. But it isn't like in the past when people would take your phone because a phone is a valuable item and they can sell it on. People are now taking phones so that they can get access to people's bank accounts and rinse their money, or kind of go shopping on an account on their phone and basically steal from them. The way people are doing this, so you might think, oh, but my phone's got a passcode, or I use Face ID, so even if somebody took my phone, they wouldn't get very far. What's happening is something called shoulder surfing. So these people will be behind you. They'll see you unlocking your phone to send a message or maybe pay for a drink at the bar, and they'll clock what your passcode is for your phone, which means that when they then take it from you, they can get into your phone. If you have the same passcode for lots of different apps on your phone, they're into those apps straight away. You might think you're safe, as I said, if you have something like Face ID or Touch ID, but you're actually not, because once someone's in your phone with your passcode, then they can go and either disable Face ID or Touch ID, or they can change it to their face or their fingerprint. So it's something that I think a lot of people don't think about, but it can be very easy if someone has your phone for them to get into all of your apps, your banking apps, your even something like your Amazon app. They could kind of go on a shopping spree and send a bunch of stuff to their address. So this is unfortunately what happened to this person. He had his phone taken, and then this person actually first went to his bank account with a high street bank. And this I find quite interesting. This is something a lot of these thieves will do. They'll go to your main bank account, where obviously most people will keep the majority of their money with a high street bank. Then they'll have a second account with one of the, as we call, sort of neo banks or app-based banks. So in this case, it was Revolut, but it could be a Monzo or a Starling. Quite often they'll take your money from, say, a NatWest or a Barclays or TSB, and they'll put it into this app-based bank as their first step. And I think why they're doing that is because it's more difficult for customers to get in touch with these app-based banks to sort of say, you know, my phone's been stolen, can you lock my account? Because quite often you can only get in touch with them in the first place via a chat. So you can't just pick up the phone and say, help me shut my account. You have to go through all these steps. So it gives the criminals a bit longer to kind of play with in terms of the time they've got to kind of take your money. I spoke to a scammer as well on this, and he thinks that actually some of their security processes are a bit more lax. So what happened in this case was they transferred a bunch of money to his Revolut, and then they used that money. It was almost £4,000. They used it to buy crypto and then presumably transferred it to a crypto wallet that they're in control of. So they've used his money to buy all this crypto. And unfortunately, when this person went to Revolut, they said, well, this happened on your phone and your passcode was entered, so we essentially think that you did it, so we're not going to refund you. Obviously, he was very not okay with that, so he contacted me. I went to them and said, look, he's got a police report, his phone's been stolen, this is fraud. And after a bit back and forth, luckily they did agree to reimburse his money. But
you say luckily.
Well, it is lucky. Unfortunately, it shouldn't be. But so many people get in touch with me, and you know, the banks can quite easily turn around and say, "Well, it happened on your phone. That whoever did this had all your information. So we therefore assume that you did it." And it can be difficult to argue against that. You know,
Revolut a bank?
They're not a bank, actually. We refer to them as a financial institution. So they don't have a banking license in the UK. They have their banking license, I believe, in Eastern Europe. So there are still some kind of protections for your money, but they are not a bank as it kind of applies to UK customers. They've struggled to get a banking license, actually, in the UK. So, but even so, it's difficult because with all the, you know, even if you're with a high street bank and you get scammed, there's still no hard and fast guarantee that they will refund you. You know, a lot of the banks are signed up to this sort of voluntary code, which says that if you get caught by a certain type of scam, then we will refund you. But it's all voluntary. There are actually more sort of strict rules coming in later in the year, which should protect people a bit better against scams. But still often it is kind of your word against the banks. And they can turn around and say, "We don't think you did enough to protect your money here," especially if you've been tricked into something like giving your information away to someone, if they were sort of pretending to be a bank or something like that. They can turn around and say, "We don't think you protected your information well enough, so we're not going to refund you." It's a really difficult one. Scams are so rampant, and unfortunately the banks are not going to refund everyone. It's just a really, really awful situation, if I'm perfectly honest.
No, it absolutely is. What did Revolut say about, well, the whole thing, but mainly that I understand the person in question tried to call them and didn't hear back. I tried to call three times and didn't. So what's the excuse for the radio silence on their customer service there?
I mean, no excuse, really. They didn't really address it directly. But I think this is a real problem. As I said, my friend who had the same thing happen to them, he was, I've written about this before, he was with Monzo, and he had the exact same situation. He said, I obviously tried to call them straight away, and you have to go through this robotic chat where it's, oh, you know, what do you want? And you're, I've been scammed. Then it's like, okay, well, we'll, you know, they put you through this online process. And I don't think he ever actually managed to speak to anyone directly on the phone, because it's all app-based, which is, in my view, not really acceptable. And it's something I think people don't really think of when they sign up to one of these app-based banks. You know, there's a lot of reasons why they're really useful. People often sign up because they have free spending abroad, their apps are really user-friendly. But I think, especially young people, it's something they don't really consider when they're signing up to a bank. You know, how would they help me if I got into a situation where I'd been scammed or had money stolen? And I think they should have a phone line. They should. Their protection should be as good as anyone else's. I should say as well, actually, the high street banks aren't completely not guilty here. A lot of them will also make you go through an automated kind of chat before you get onto the phone, but they are generally slightly better at actually getting you to a real human quicker. But I do think it's a problem across the whole kind of banking industry. You know, when you have an emergency like this, you just want to be able to pick up the phone to someone, and often it's not as easy as it should be.
Banking, utilities, you name it. I just want to take a moment, though, to give a shout out to Octopus. I couldn't find a number. And actually, in the end, a chap called JJ was absolutely marvellous. I mean, honestly, it was absolutely marvellous. Email, obviously, I didn't actually get to talk to them. But shout out there for the customer service. As online customer journey services go, it was brilliant. Personal, got it sorted out. Literally, honestly, I don't think this person slept. I think JJ is just a name. Everybody's called JJ, and whoever was it just jumped on the email chain. But anyway, sorry, Simon, you're about to say something there.
No, I think that's important to say, Georgie, on your point. But I think actually going on from your point, one of the problems is not just organizations, you know, banks as well. Banks shouldn't be doing this. Definitely shouldn't be doing this. But, you know, big organizations, big public organizations are hiding their phone numbers. They've started hiding their emails as well. You know, it's very difficult to contact a lot of companies via email now. They want you to go through the chat. And what they want you to do is go through the chat, and then basically either you get directed to their FAQs, which is the chat. That's what the chat wants to do. direct you to the FAQs. Because to begin with, you're not talking to a real person. If you wait and you manage to get through to a real person, then sometimes they can be really good. Mm. But they don't want you emailing them. Or they'll give you a form. Even the forms can be quite hard to find. But and that's because they don't. The email is an official complaint to them, and you've got a record of it. They don't want that. They don't want to deal with it. They don't want to deal with it in the way they should be dealing with it. And I think that it's pretty bad how they're absenting themselves from their customer responsibility in this way. But what I would say also, you know, in the hat tip moment is Nationwide, right? I take my hat off to Nationwide because I had to phone them to try and do something over summer and discovered not only could I phone Nationwide and talk to a real person, I could still phone my branch. I could actually phone my local branch of Nationwide, who was super, super helpful. So well done, Nationwide, for sticking to that, because it'd be really easy to bin that, seeing as almost every other bank has. But well done, Nationwide, for sticking to that.
Absolutely. Helen, just to return back to this particular case, look, financial services companies, we can't rely on them. So we've sort of got to, as always, take things into our own hands here. But what are the tips with this particular case? Like, hide your phone. Is there sort of some screen you can get to cover your phone? Give us some practical tips.
Yeah, you can get a privacy screen, which my brother has one of these, actually, which his work gives out to everyone that works there. So people can't be kind of looking over your shoulder on the computer and see private stuff. It's quite a good idea. It's basically like the, like blackout windows on cars, like that, but for phones. So that's quite handy. I actually spoke to a security expert called Jake Moore. He gave some really, really helpful tips for how you can protect your phone, especially if you're in a busy public place where people might be on the lookout to sort of check your password and then maybe take your phone. So he said the first thing, obviously, basically treat your phone passcode like you would your PIN number. So if you have to enter it and you're in a busy public place, cover it with your hand. It sounds really basic, doesn't it? Look over your shoulder to make sure no one can see what you're doing. That's the first step, quite an obvious one, I suppose. But I think people don't treat their phone passcode like their PIN number, do they? You're on your phone. You're not really necessarily looking around to see who's there, but it's a good idea to do that. He suggested only keeping apps that are absolutely vital on your phone. So not, if you have, say, I don't know, the Amazon app, but you don't really use it very often, consider deleting it and just downloading it again when you need to use it. It's difficult to say it with banking apps, isn't it? Because so many people use them so often. But perhaps if you do have a Revolut or a Monzo that you only use for going on holiday, consider deleting it from your phone for the rest of the year, just so it's not there in a thief's face if they do get their hands on your phone. That's something I'm considering, actually. Getting rid of my sort of holiday banking app for the rest of the year. It just kind of seems to make sense. Another really useful thing that he pointed out, and I didn't know about this, this is something quite recent that Apple has brought in, and it actually sounds quite helpful. So it's called Stolen Device Protection. It was introduced in March, and this is something that iPhone users can get, but you do have to opt into it. So there's, if you look at the story that everyone has, there's a link to the page on Apple's website where it explains how to do this. But basically, among other things, this means that if your phone is an unfamiliar place, so somewhere that you haven't taken it for, not your home, not your workplace, not the kind of place that you usually go, that will mean that in those locations, things like your credit card can only be accessed if you use Face ID or Touch ID. And it means that you won't be able to enter the passcode as kind of a backup. So, sometimes your Face ID won't work and it will say, put in your passcode. In those situations, if you opt into this, that won't happen. So it means that someone who's seen your passcode and isn't you, doesn't have your face, won't be able to enter that passcode, and it could prevent them from getting into, say, your banking app or using your credit card. And it also puts a time delay on certain actions, such as changing your password, which would basically give you, people talk about a kind of golden hour when someone steals your phone, which means that all the money and all the transactions are going to happen will normally happen within the first hour that person has the phone. This will basically block someone from changing the password for that hour, which would give you really useful time to report it as stolen, get your SIM blocked and things like that. So if you do have an iPhone, stolen device protection, something that is definitely worth looking into activating.
I've literally written that down, all of those things, especially this privacy screen protector things. You can get them for laptops too. So Helen, as always, fantastic. That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by David Kell of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Explained feature on the podcast. David, welcome to the podcast. Here's what sounds like a simple question, but I bet the answer isn't quite as simple as it could be. If I buy a global tracker fund, where in the world does it invest?
Well, that would depend on which type of global tracker you consider, because some of the trackers are named global and invest in the developed world. You also get trackers which are called all world and will include emerging markets within them. Therefore, not all global trackers are the same. What they tend to share in common, though, is that they invest in companies based on their market capitalization, which means the bigger the company, the larger the allocation will be to the fund. Generally, a fund will have around 1,500 stocks within the portfolio. However, there's some funds out there that have over 3,500 stocks in them. Technology tends to dominate these indexes and account for around about 25% of the allocation with a fund. And Microsoft and Apple take up the lion's share with around about 10% of this. And the remainder of the funds tend to be spread across sectors such as financials, consumer discretionary, industrials, healthcare, and some others.
So is this a simple starting point for people when they're investing?
In short, yes, a global tracker is a very convenient way to invest in a portfolio of global stocks. You need to decide which one you want to do, whether it's be global or all world. You should also consider the cost of the tracker, as they do vary a lot from one provider to the next, whilst also your investing need to be in other assets such as fixed interest, infrastructure, cash for an overall diverse portfolio.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Not a day goes by when we don't hear a story or piece of research about how we are all, frankly, screwed in retirement because we are not saving enough. Simon laughing there, chuckling to himself. But should you really worry about paying more into your pension? Asks our Simon. Simon, what? Of course we should. We should panic. We should self-flagellate because we are all useless, not saving enough for retirement. Spendthrift, is that the word?
Yes.
Thrift? Right, I can't remember whether that's the good thing or the bad thing. Anyway, Simon.
Okay, listeners. Now that Georgie has done her stream of consciousness on pension saving.
Yeah. And you can do yours.
Yeah, I'll do mine. Yeah. So we'd be less sort of like random thought association and maybe potentially more related to what I wrote my column about this week. But before I start, I need to ask you to bear with me, and not just because of Georgie's random stream of pension.
Bear with me so there. Far. They can bear with you.
Okay, if you've got this far, well done. Now bear with me a little bit longer. Right, pension saving. I realise that this is going to sound like the complete opposite of what we normally say, which is what I think my esteemed podcast colleague was trying to get at just now. But we are usually telling you to save as much as you can into your pension. Your pensions, you know, you need to start saving, you need to start saving early, you need to be responsible for your retirement, and so on and so on. But there is a thought in my head, and the thought in my head is it really wise for me to pay as much as possible into my pension? And also, is it really wise for people in general to pay as much as possible into their pension? And here's why. You can't get at your pension currently until you are 55. That's going up to 57 very soon. I probably won't be able to get at my pension until I'm 58. I'm 45 now. And the reason for this is because the point at which you can access your pension is linked to the state pension age, and it's the state pension age minus 10 years. So my state pension age is currently officially set at 68. So I reckon I'm not going to be able to get to my pension until I'm 58. That's not actually set in stone right now, but it's pretty sure that that's going to happen. Now, that's sort of okay. I'm relying on my pension to fund my retirement. I'm not planning probably on full-time retiring before the age of 58. But maybe I might want to have the option to. And if I do want to have the option to, I know that I'm going to need to rely on something that isn't my pension to carry me through. You know, like maybe I dial back on working or something, you know, stop working full time. But there's a risk. And the risk comes from a government. This government may be. This government may not be around for long. I don't know if anybody's heard that, but this government may not be around for long. Or the next government, or the next government after that, whacking up the state pension age. And if they don't change the rules about when you can access your work pension, which, you know, they may not do, all of a sudden you could find the point at which you can access your work pension or your SIP that you've got, whether if you've got extra pots on the side or if you're self-employed, you'll be relying on a SIP or a personal pension, starts drifting into the future. And you might suddenly discover that this has a much greater impact on your aspirations for retirement than the state pension age actually does. So we normally talk about state pension age, but actually for many people, the state pension is only going to be a chunk of their retirement income. It's currently worth about £11,000 a year. Now, I reckon lots of our podcast listeners are going to be hoping to retire with an income of considerably more than £11,000 a year. They might be looking at the PLSA figures, for example, which have told them how much a comfortable retirement's going to cost, or a moderate one. They might be thinking that actually, you know, once they factor everything in, they're probably going to be needing more like £30,000 or £40,000 a year. So the rest of that's going to have to be picked up by their personal pension. If you suddenly discover that you can't get that personal pension until you're 62, 63. I mean, God, there was even like mad talk this week with the pointless point scoring that goes on amongst politicians about state pensions at 75, 65. Well, that's going to make a big difference to you. So, you know, ideally, I'd like to retire before my state pension, which is 68, or at least have the option to. And, you know, I'm sort of, you know, maybe I won't. I'll probably get to that age and I'll continue working. I'll probably still be working in my mid-70s, you know, but maybe I won't want to. And I'm acutely conscious of the fact that, you know, my dad died 10 years ago and he was only 66. And that was just a few years after he retired. And at that point, it very much focused my mind on the fact that I wanted to have a decent retirement before the age of 66, just in case kind of thing, you know. So what do you do? Well, maybe that means that you need to be putting a bit more money into your ISA instead and not just whacking it all into your pension. And this is just common sense. It's not putting all your eggs in one basket. It's hedging your bets. It's however you want to refer to it, because you can use that ISA to draw on at any time and take that income. Now, the problem is you're not going to get pension tax relief and you're not going to get the benefit of your employer's contributions if you're not already maxing those out. And you're going to have some discipline as well, because the great advantage of a pension is that you cannot get the money until you are 55, whilst the great disadvantage of a pension is also that you cannot get the money until you are 55. But it means that you can't tap it up early. And I would say that people should always pay as much as possible into their work pension to max out their employer's contributions. If your employer will match it or double it or whatever, pay as much in until they stop doing that. Otherwise, you are leaving free money on the table. You'll also get the benefit of tax relief, basic rate tax relief, 25% automatically added. And if you're a high rate taxpayer, you can claim the rest back. And if you do claim the rest back, shove that into your pension instead. But often we hear talk of like, just put more money into your pension, just put more money into your pension. But I'm not so sure that the case for that is always absolutely clear.
So in that case, what's the sensible suggestion?
To spread your bets, to put some money into your ISA as well. Invest it into a stocks and shares ISA if you're thinking long term. Obviously, you can have some in a cash ISA, but you don't want to rely too much on cash. The best returns over the long term are going to come from the stock market. Get it into a stocks and shares ISA. Do something sensible with it. Listen to last week's podcast if you want to listen about the advantages of sensible shoes, tracker investing over trying to pick winners. And then just sit back, relax, and hopefully you're rich enough to make a choice in your mid-50s about whether you want to work or not.
True, true. Well, thank you very much, Simon. We're going to stick with pensions, though. I read a question. I have £300,000 in a SIPP that I don't need. This isn't me, obviously, as I have a final salary pension income and ISAs that I can draw on. I'm widowed with six young grandchildren, and I'm considering leaving this pension pot to them. But would they have to wait until they reach 57 to withdraw money from the pension? Or could they take it out earlier? They could. Would they have to take it all in one go, or could they leave it in there and draw on it when they wanted to? Lots of questions in there. Helen, do you want to take this one? What are the rules?
So this person is thinking quite sensibly, actually. If you're in this fortunate position where you have a lot of money to potentially leave to your grandchildren, doing it through a pension can be quite a good idea. It can be quite tax efficient, certainly probably more than just leaving it to them in cash. But clearly, as we just said, pensions, lots of rules about when and how you can access them. So they're essentially asking, if I left to my grandchildren, would they have to wait to their pension age? And the answer to that, luckily, is no. So if it's a pension that you inherit, you don't need to wait until you hit 57 in order to withdraw that. So it can be a good idea, but there are other things that you need to think about. So our reporter Harvey has spoken to a couple of experts about this, and they've kind of gone through things that you need to think about if you're considering leaving a pension to someone as an inheritance. First of all, quite basic, they've said, make sure your pension provider knows that this is what you want to do. Quite often with cases of things like inheritance and making sure your wishes are fulfilled after your death, it's something that people kind of put off and don't think about. So really important thing, fill out what's called an expression of wish and nomination form, with your pension provider, which tells them who'd like to inherit your pension after your death. That's not binding, but your wishes are strongly taken into account after you die. So that is a really good thing to do. When it comes to the actual inheritance, in the case of a SIPP, the beneficiaries basically have two options. So they can get it as a lump sum, or they can get something called a beneficiary drawdown, which is where the money retains in this sort of stays in the pension wrapper, but they can sort of draw it down over time as and when they please, which can actually be more sort of beneficial for them because it means it will stay in that sort of tax-free status over time. Again, there are no sort of restrictions on this in terms of age, so that's something that could be very good for this person's grandchildren. There are obviously tax considerations that come into play as well. You know, unfortunately, these grandchildren are not just going to get this completely tax-free. So there are, if they took a lump sum payout, there is a sort of two-year rule. So this means the money must be paid out within 2 years of the scheme administrator being informed of the person's death. If it takes longer than 2 years, that money could be taxable. Mm-hmm. Give me 1 second, just scrolling mm-hmm. through the article. And another option, of course, is to, if you didn't want to go down the pension route, you could give money to them while you're still alive. As I think we've talked about before, there's this 7-year rule. So if you gift money within certain limits to someone more than 7 years before you pass away, and then that money can be tax-free, and that money could be withdrawn from the SIPP as well. So there's lots of different options for this person to consider.
Yeah, I think the ultimate piece of advice would be probably speak to a professional about the tax implications, because it seems that there are a fair few, Simon.
Yeah, there are. And we talk about pensions being inheritance tax friendly, but, you know, that's only because they're outside of the inheritance tax net. And if you die below a certain age, below 75, there's no tax for your beneficiaries to pay. But if you die after 75, which quite a lot of people will do, then there is tax, and that means your beneficiaries will get taxed on it at their own rate of tax. But the money that they take out is going to be added to their other income that year to decide that rate of tax. So if you've got a scenario where they took £50,000 out, well, that's going to definitely put them in the higher rate tax bracket, because the higher rate tax bracket starts at £50,000. So they'd probably have to take it out gradually. And there is a lot of talk about inheriting pensions, but there's also not a lot of understanding about how the system actually works, like leading to the question of, well, do they have to wait until they're 57 to get the money out, or 58, as I explained a minute ago? To which the answer is fortunately not. So, but it is a good idea, you know. So say you're in a position where you've got grandchildren, right? Mm. And you've got some money in a pension, and you look at that pension, you go, do you know what? I've got income from elsewhere. I don't actually need the money in that pension. It's a good way to go, right, I'm going to ring fence that money for my grandchildren, because you might want to leave your estate to your children, for example. You go, right, I'm going to ring fence that money for my grandchildren. They can have that. It's invested, so hopefully it's going to go up in value over time. You know, and this is an instance where someone's talking about having grandchildren under the age of 10.
Yeah.
That money's invested. It's going to go up in value over time. And eventually, when those grandchildren perhaps go to take that money out, you know, in their 20s or 30s when they want to buy a property, that's going to really, really, really help them out. And it's a good example of thinking ahead and, you know, doing a good kind of intergenerational wealth transfer, which I think a lot of people want to do. They'd like to give their money to their loved ones, or to, you know, to their children, to their grandchildren, but they want to kind of do it in the right way, and also not just hand over cash. People are really worried about handing over large sums of cash.
Yeah, quite. All right, then, finally, security experts warn that passwords are becoming no longer fit for purpose, which for me is a good thing, because I can never remember mine. So is the answer passkeys? Well, apparently they're the future. But what are they, and how do they work? Helen, firstly, what's wrong with passwords?
Yeah, so I don't know if you know, Georgie, but yesterday was actual National Password Day. So happy National Password Day to all who celebrate. What's wrong with passwords? I mean, I think we all know what's wrong with passwords, don't we? You're supposed to have these secure passwords that contain capital letters, numbers, special characters, but they're really difficult to remember. And of course, we're not supposed to write them down or keep them on our phone anywhere. And it's just extremely difficult to keep your passwords in your head. So enter passkeys, basically, which I only found out what a passkey was this week, if I'm perfectly honest, but they do sound like quite a good idea. So how they work is quite complicated, but it seems that using one could actually be quite easy. So passkeys, as we say in the article, are unique identifiers that are generated by a user's device, such as a mobile phone, and linked to the website or application that they want to log into. So basically, your phone stores a piece of code, and the website or app that you want to log into stores another piece of code, right? And when you go to log into them, those two pieces of code work together to prove that the person who owns this device is allowed to enter this app. So you don't need to remember anything. You just have to have your phone. You also, and this is quite important, need to access it via what they call biometrics. So your face or your fingerprint, which stops someone, as we talked about in the Crane on the Case story before, someone who has your phone accessing it who isn't you. So basically these three things come together: your device, the website or app, and your face ID. And that is proof enough to get you into whatever you want to get into without having to remember a bunch of random characters. It all seems quite good, doesn't it, really? It's, you know, clearly with all these things, I think the caveat is eventually, if this becomes more common, scammers, criminals are always going to find a way to get around these things, I assume. However, it seems more difficult to do than seeing someone type in a passcode or a password, or guessing a passcode or a password, because still the most popular passcode is 123456, which is absolutely ridiculous. So I mean, this has got to be better than having a passcode 123456, right? I think.
I mean, yes. Simon, is it the future? Simon,
and just, is it the future? And just to be clear, if you write password, but just to put two fives instead of the S's, that apparently is not considered secure either. That doesn't pass National Password Day test.
Shock.
So, yeah, it's, you know, if it's really obvious, don't do it.
No.
You'd like to think the thieves would think it was so obvious that they wouldn't try it, but I'm pretty sure that there's a massive hit rate from scammers just going, all right, password, two fives. We're in 123456, first of all. I think that this is a really good idea. I think that it falls down slightly in the sense that people go for what's easy for them. And also, it's really annoying when you want to get into something and you don't have your phone with you if you need your phone to get into it. I mean, obviously, most people have their phones with them most of the time. As a measure of how annoying it is, it's like, you know, when Apple offers to create a secure password for you, and it's like some jumble of madness when you sign up to something new. I always find that really annoying, if my wife has done it and I'm trying to get into something that she's got the login for, and I can't do that because I don't have her device and therefore the jumbled password, which illustrates A, how this goes against human behavior and annoys human behavior. Just to say, my wife would know that I was trying to get into one of these things. You know, this would be some kind of shared account or something that we had, but that she had the login for. But B also illustrates how much secure it is, because it means that you can't hack into your partner's account when you need to get in and do something quickly. So I don't know. Maybe they'll take off. It's like the biometrics. I mean, how many people use biometrics versus just using a PIN number? I think quite a lot of people use facial recognition, don't they? I don't use facial recognition. I'm not a big fan of it.
Mine's
The
automatic on my phone.
thumbprint thing, that's a big favorite of people. People love the thumbprint, although all devices seem to hate my thumbprint for some reason. I don't know what I've done to my thumb at some point in my life, but all devices seem to hate it. So I don't know. I mean, it does cause a problem when you need to do something and you can't get in. I've been at a party at a friend's house before where it was her house, and so the music was on her phone on the speaker. And every time me and my friend wanted to change something, we had to get her to put her face on the screen. And it started out with a, "Oh, excuse me, could you just, would you
Then it was
mind just
like in
moving the
the
screen?" And then it was just eventually ended up with us just shoving the phone in her face.
face. Oh dear. Yes. I mean, my biggest problem with anything that you need a separate device for, like your phone, is again, and it goes back to the story Helen had earlier, is what happens when you leave your phone in an Uber or it gets stolen. I was caught in a somewhat Kafkaesque nightmare of trying to get my phone back when I left it in an Uber. I did have my laptop, but it kept saying you need two-step authentication using your phone. I was like, I don't have my phone. Oh my God, it was
Well,
just
that's the problem with the two-factor
a
authentication, isn't it? It's like, if you don't have the phone on you, you've got a
nightmare.
problem. You're stuffed. You know, this is an issue. Or if your phone battery dies, which that's not a totally unusual scenario.
No, indeed not. Right, that is it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
Email us, stick podcast in the subject line, or tweet us at thisismoney.co.uk, or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade in shares, funds, investment trusts, and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.